Welcome to the News Talk Hour here on Cliff Central. I'm Mabale Moloi, and to help me out to get through some of the top news stories over the next hour, from the Daily Maverick, Ranjeni and Stilly joining me this afternoon. Good afternoon, guys.
Hi, Mabale.
How are you guys doing?
Well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Ranjeni, you had an interesting couple of days in Cape Town. You were in Parliament for a while. Got to see all the action firsthand.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a good thing, eh? Gives you nightmares.
I just
imagine like red Teletubby screaming at you in the middle of the night.
I just wonder if our parliament will ever get as exciting as some of those parliaments you see in the Asian countries where it gets physical.
Yeah, the physical fights.
They pick chairs up and they start smashing each other with chairs. Wouldn't that be a sight?
I wonder how far off away from that we are.
We did have a bust up once.
Oh, yeah, tell me.
Yeah, well, a couple of years ago, it was Johnny De Lange, and it was when the National Party, I think, the new National Party was still in existence.
Yeah.
I forget the guy's name from the National Party. Yeah, but they did come to
brawl.
To fist, yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh.
But Lekem Bete also have a big shouting match at one stage as well with one of the DA members of parliament as well. She huffed and puffed and basically stopped short of throwing something at him.
Yes, yeah, no, I remember that. But also the one time the one DA MP got chucked out for swearing, using the F word in Parliament.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
You know, it's just ironic because when you think of Parliament, you think, oh, well, you know, it's supposed to be this place of decorum and order. And
well, I think that's coming to a very rapid end.
Yeah.
Thanks to the economic freedom fighters.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is your view on that, Ranjeni? I'd like to know. I mean, there's this freedom of speech, and you look at what Julius was put back in his place for about. You know, I'm kind of in two minds about it, you know, in terms of did he have a valid argument in saying to the Speaker that she shouldn't be dictating to him what he can or cannot debate, and then also following those parliamentary rules of how we debate in Parliament.
Yeah, look, as far as Julius Malema is concerned, he did nothing untoward as far as I'm concerned. You're there to box clever and to make your points, which he did. And, you know, if things get rough and if he says things that, you know, make the NC uncomfortable, well, that's what he's there to do precisely,
yeah.
You know?
That's what he gets paid R1 million
and
to do.
I think he made a very good point, but, you know, about insisting. Look, he picked up a good issue. The Marikana issue was spot on. And where he says that he's not going to retract his allegation that the ANC government is responsible for killing people, because when the police, you know, when the successes with the police, the ANC government is credited. And therefore, if there's criticism against the police, the ANC government needs to shoulder that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Where things got out of hand is what happened after he was booted out. Because then the EFF MP started screaming, and, you know,
making some very strong allegations.
Yes, and like referring to the chair, Thandi Modise, as Thandi by her first name,
mm-hmm.
saying, Thandi, you were the premier. So that, I think, you know, was stepped over the line.
Yeah.
Because that definitely exceeded the decorum of parliament. And look, there should be rules. There should, it is... you know, it's just not like a shebeen. It's you know, it's a place where there should be rules, but it's there precisely for intense and fierce debate. So don't restrict that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the ANC likes to give as well. We saw the young MP Stella and Ndabeni Abrahams who were saying to the DA, "We moved you." You know, but she was called back on that to retract the statement. But then when the ANC wants to, they lay it on quite heavy as well. So they need to be able to get a thick skin and know that, you know, things are changing and the EFF is not going to be playing by the rules.
I think a lot of us were appreciative of Julius making us chuckle a little bit, because I think the general response was, you know, he's so funny. But I think if that would become a normal practice for the EFF to do, if that were to be their normal approach in parliament, then I think we'd start having a problem with it, because, you know, then they would just turn it into a joke or a circus the whole time.
Yeah, well, now it's a novelty. You know, he's new and everybody's interested in what he has to say, and everything he does, it's the first time Julius is speaking, it's the first time he's, you know, throwing his toys. So, you know, for now, it's fine. Everybody's paying attention. But after a while, I think it'll get a bit stale.
Yeah.
And also once Parliament settles into its business, you know, the normal course of business and the committee meetings. Look, the National Assembly doesn't sit all the time. So most of the work of Parliament happens behind the scenes. We don't see it. There's no media coverage of it. And I think the EFF is also going to get a bit bored with that. Because, you know, they like to throw punches and make big statements and, you know, make the headlines. But when, you know, they can't do that, although it's completely unsustainable for them to keep doing that. So I think give it a month or two and then it'll settle down.
We had Gladys Breitenbach on the Breakfast Show earlier this week. And I think it's also going to be interesting to see her in Parliament because, you know, she's a very tough cookie. She doesn't mess around. She doesn't take anybody's nonsense. And she's quite intimidating, just, you know, her presence alone. So I think that's also going to be interesting to observe for a different reason, not so much from a comical perspective.
Yes, I mean, she's a prosecutor and a top prosecutor at that, and she knows the law and she understands the justice system intricately from being inside it. So I think she brings a new dimension to the debates, whereas you just have politicians, you know, flinging accusations and things. I think she will bring a new perspective. But yeah, she is intimidating. I don't think anybody's going to try and, you know, just you draw her into a fight too quickly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she'll be able to give as good as she gets as well.
But I wouldn't agree with the sentiment that that Julius in particular was just grandstanding. I think that a lot of his arguments were valid and he was challenging the ANC, and that's where the whole ruckus stemmed from, was those points that he was challenging the ANC on. And I don't think we can just call it showboating or grandstanding for the sake of it. I think there were some very valid points there that were raised.
I agree with you 100%. I just worry for the EFF if their valid points are going to get lost in the theatrics that accompany the message. But I hear what you're saying.
And also following blindly an anti-ANC sentiment that, you know, that we've seen with some other parties choose that road as well. So if it is just blindly anti-ANC all the time, it's going to get lost in the rhetoric.
Yeah,
that's what true. I think was also interesting, Mabale, was that I think President Zuma felt the sting, because in his reply to the State of the Nation debate, he was saying, yeah, we need to grow up. And I was watching the debate here and a lot of people were just scoring points and we need to act in the interest of the nation. So I think that it was quite a brutal debate. And you've got all these new players in the House now. And it's, you know, President Zuma coasted by quite comfortably in the last term because Parliament was quite soft on him and it was quite difficult, you know, to get him in the hot seat and get him to answer questions. And I think he realizes that the ball game has changed now. And especially with the EFF MPs in the House now, he's not going to just get away with saying what he wants to say and sit down. They're going to challenge him. They're going to work outside the box this time. So he knows it, and that's why he's trying to caution it and saying, oh, there are rules here, and let's be decent about it. But I don't think they're going to listen, because you should have seen the look on Julius Malema's face when he was saying that. It was like, yeah, right, I'm going to listen to you. I'm coming for you.
And then also considering his history with Julius Malema, and you're right, the president knows that Julius is coming for him.
Yes.
There's a lot of emotion in all of that. It's,
and that's
it's personal between the two
personal.
Of them. Yeah.
And that's precisely why Julius was kicked out of the ANC, because he took him on inside the ANC. And now, and a lot of that was behind the scenes. So we don't know how rough it got.
Yeah.
But now it's going to be happening before our very eyes, you know, and you can't conceal it. So I think the president is worried that Julius is going to embarrass him.
Yeah. Okay, well, 0861-555-189 is the number to call if you'd like to be a part of our discussion this afternoon over the next hour or so. You can also send us your messages through WeChat. So one of the stories that is, of course, making international headlines is the story out of Egypt with the three journalists that were found guilty and have now been sentenced. Rights activists, bloggers, and journalists in Egypt responded with dismay after an Egyptian court sentenced three journalists to long prison terms despite a lack of evidence that the men who worked for Al Jazeera had done anything but report on the unrest in the country. How does this reflect on the Egyptian government, Stilly?
Terribly. You can imagine that across the world, every media organization, every media freedom organization is up in arms at this. I mean, many people were expecting these cases to be chucked out. A lot of people were saying that just the detention of these journalists was a joke. So for them to be actually convicted and given sentences that were even more were stricter and more onerous than what Mubarak got for his corruption charges is laughable, really. So, you know, the whole world, the whole media world is really reeling in shock from this. And it sends a very clear message to the rest of the world that Egypt isn't interested in media freedom. Egypt isn't interested in a democratic process or a judiciary that is independent, you know, of its rulers.
And also, Egypt have just come out of a tumultuous, you know, reign. They're starting over. They're kind of like a new government. So that obviously has a big role to play in this whole situation and how it's panned out, right?
Yeah, you would think that that Egypt would at least have been mindful of what the U.S. is saying, because the U.S. does play a kind of big brother role in international politics. And John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, actually phoned the Egyptian president about this matter, as did the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott. And it seems that the Egyptian government simply just disregarded what Big Brother is saying. That's quite scary, because it means that you know, they just don't care what the rest of the world thinks. But I think it's also quite chilling, you know, for the journalistic fraternity internationally. I think the scariest thing about this is that the images that came out from that case, where these journalists were in that cage, you know, as if they were hardened criminals. You know, it's and if you look at what they're accused of, you know, reporting on the Muslim Brotherhood,
supporting terrorist organizations.
Yeah, you know, it's can you imagine if something like that happened? You report on, say, the economic freedom fighters, and then suddenly you're accused of supporting terrorism.
Essentially, serious allegations are being made against these journalists, but with very little evidence.
Yes, I mean, the whole trial was a sham. You know, the witnesses were contradicting their statements, and there wasn't no firm case presented by the prosecution. So, you know, there's still the option open of an appeal, but even that could turn out to be a sham. The final option will be the possibility of a presidential pardon. But if the Egyptian president doesn't even care, you know, what his counterparts around the world are saying, you know, he may not be open to a pardon.
Mm. On the issue of the evidence that was presented, I read somewhere, and I haven't had a chance to go and verify all these, but there was very little evidence that the prosecution offered to the court. And even then, the defense was asked to pay a sum of $100,000 to be able to see this evidence as well as part of the defense process. Now, I mean, I don't know if those reports have been confirmed, but, you know, can you imagine what kind of process they went through, and, you know, the lack of due process that went through in this case for those guys to be convicted of up to 7 years in some cases? I mean, it's a complete sham.
Our colleague Simon Allison wrote about this matter today, and one of the things he pointed out is that the U.S. Funds the Egyptian government, gives them $1.3 billion U.S. dollars for military support.
So now what is this going to mean going forward on a political level?
Exactly. And the U.S. can obviously wield the big stick and say, we're taking our money away.
Yes.
But, I mean, surely the Egyptian president would have been aware of that. You don't just stick your middle finger up at the U.S. president. I mean, the U.S. Secretary of State, knowing you're getting $1.3 billion from him. And he has the ability to withdraw that at any time. So, yeah, it shows that, you know, there's a level of defiance that nobody can quite understand this time.
I came across an article where somebody said what this shows is that it's becoming increasingly dangerous to be a journalist. But my question is, hasn't it always been a dangerous field to be in as a journalist? I mean, if you consider our history when reporters were choosing to shed light on the whole apartheid regime as opposed to what they were instructed to report on by governments. Those were dangerous times for those journalists. It's always been that case, has it not?
Well, the continent hasn't been a very friendly place to journalists over the last, you know, let's say 100 years or so. And we've seen it in various countries, and, you know, as it goes through various stages of democracy and freedom, you know, we always hoped that we were moving in the right direction. But it's very sad to see that in places like Egypt and just even in South Africa, we seem to be going a little bit backwards when it comes to media freedom and issues of governance and transparency in our media. I mean, we saw not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, we saw marches on the Mail and Guardian. We saw marches on EWN, you know, for stances, for editorial stances that these media houses were taking. We've seen, you know, journalists being bugged by the national security organizations in this country. So it does seem to be going backwards, and it does seem to be a very, very big problem across the continent.
Yeah, I think, it has always been hazardous for journalists to work in conflict zones, and particularly in the Middle East. We saw a South African journalist, Anton Hamel, a photographer, was killed in
it was Libya.
Libya, yes. Yeah. You kind of expect that, you know, there are dangers that come with reporting on conflict zones, but it's a whole other matter when journalists face prosecution. And look, there's also the other matter of harassment, as Stille points out, you know, from the intelligence agencies and things. But prosecution is, that you only get in the fiercest of regimes. I think there's now a growing danger and an awareness around the world that, you know, it's not just a matter of getting caught in the crossfire anymore in a conflict zone, but there are new hazards facing journalists, such as, where these new regimes come up and then impose all sorts of embargoes on journalists.
And what threat does this pose for media freedom, which Stille, you touched on just a second ago, in a country like Egypt?
Well, obviously, the biggest danger for now is self-censorship. Because, you know, journalists there who are reporting in Egypt at the moment will be worried about what they can and cannot report. And so they will hold back. This sets a very dangerous precedent because, you face a 7-year sentence. And, with all the international pressure on this trial, and, you know, the journalists still were convicted. So for others sitting in newsrooms in Egypt at the moment, they are going to tread very, very carefully, which means that the Egyptian public, as well as the, Al Jazeera is an international broadcaster, for example, they'll be worried about what they report from now on because they don't want any more of their staff to undergo, you know, the same treatment. So I think that is the biggest danger to press freedom is, you know, that kind of restraints.
We've also seen some in a satirical program in Egypt, you know, pulling themselves off the air.
Yes.
Really worried about, you know, if we carry on doing what we're doing, there's a very good chance we're going to end up being prosecuted by the state.
So I think even a blogger was one of the people who also got caught in the crossfires and was also
arrested. Arrested. So, you know, you're going to think twice about putting pen to paper or putting, you know, words to web pages going forward, because, you know, that's the effect that these sentences is now going to have on the rest of the media in the country.
We did see a lot of support, though, for these Al Jazeera journalists from other journalists from the international media, especially through social media. You know, we saw the Twitter campaigns, you know, which is kind of like how journalism is done these days. Yes. So we did see a lot of support, but at the end of the day, that didn't really do anything for them.
That's the problem with social media campaigns, and what people have been pointing out about the Bring Back the Girls campaign is that it's high profile for people like us who dwell on social media, and who have internet access and things like that. But for the people affected, in the case of Boko Haram and in this case the Egyptian government, it has no bearing whatsoever.
Do you think it makes the situation worse for them potentially?
It could cause more aggression. In terms of Boko Haram, I don't even know if they know, that whole campaign, that international campaign is going on.
Yeah.
And I don't think they care. But for the Egyptian government, it probably made them more hostile. And they felt under siege. And they also probably wanted to teach, the journalists a lesson and set the precedent that has been set now.
I have a question for you too. I mean, having a look at the three biggest economies in Africa, Nigeria, South Africa, and Egypt are the three biggest things. And we've seen Boko Haram and other killings and kidnappings happening in Nigeria. In South Africa, we've seen the platinum strike going on for the last 5 months, crippling the economy of South Africa. And you've got these sentences now being dished out in Egypt. You know, as an investment destination, you know, what does it say to the investing public or the investors overseas who are looking to Africa as the growth opportunity. We hear it, you know, Africa rising, the next growth place. You know, what is this? Imagine what the perception is to those investors now when the three biggest economies are having these kinds of problems.
And also the kind of strain that it's putting on those international relations.
Yes. Look, I think, you know, we were meant to be in the golden age now of Africa rising. If you remember Thabo Mbeki's dream of a new partnership for Africa's development and, you know, that the time had come for Africa's big change. And, you know, 10 years ago, everyone had this romantic image about what Africa was going to be.
Mm.
But I think that whole project has fell to pieces because you've been seen a reversal in you know, in so many ways. And you've seen a rollback of democratic freedoms. You've seen new conflicts arise in the continent. And, you know, even in our country, you know, I think the danger of the secrecy bill, you know, just the fact that it has gone through parliament and everything that civil society has done to try and stop it, and it's still sitting on the president's desk at the moment. So that danger is still hanging over us. So, you know, and that has led to lots of alarm bells ringing around the world, you know, about how free our press will be once that is passed, and what restraints there'll be, both in terms of what the action government will take and of self-censorship. You know, because people will be scared to report. But in terms of that, the impact on Africa is that I don't think, you know, that the three biggest economies should be setting the example. It should be model states in terms of, you know, its security, in terms of
press freedom, in terms of governance.
Yes, and the economic vibrancy and good investment destination. And you see all of that is, you know, slowly deteriorating. So it's extremely worrying. The AU, I think, is losing its profile and its influence on member states. I don't think anybody is, you know, scared of it. Certainly, I haven't seen the influence of the AU in this Egypt matter.
Yeah. Or in the Nigerian situation.
In the Nigerian situation, you know, it is quite invisible in it. So whatever the intention was for the AU to play a central role in terms of uniting and advancing Africa's cause, I think all of that has taken a serious hit now.
And then you also have those sections within on the African continent that really don't want the West getting involved in our business, so to speak. They would prefer to have the West at an arm's length. You know, you look at the kind of organizations like Boko Haram, for example, where for them, you know, Western involvement is a no-no.
Yeah, I mean, with Boko Haram, education of any sort is seen to be the influence of the West.
Of the West, which is problematic for
them. I mean, that's exactly what the entire terrorist organization is about, is preventing that Western influence. But in terms of African countries, yes, I mean, there is this thing that, you know, that the Western world shouldn't interfere in domestic and sovereign affairs. And that's why you even get African nations closing ranks around countries like Zimbabwe and saying, no, we'll sort out our own problems, leave us alone, we'll do it ourselves.
Mm.
But what happened in Nigeria is that once the situation hit the situation it is, where, you know, there's nobody in the African continent can come up with any way of finding where the girls are, then they look to the United States to say, oh, please lend us your drones. And, you know, to come and help. So, you know, it's everything is kind of like on Africa's terms. Don't interfere with us. But when we need you, can you please come help us?
Mm. But what happens next now with these journalists? They've been found guilty. They've been sentenced. Is there anything that they can do at this stage? Can the international community get involved in any way? What happens next?
There's going to be an appeal process for sure. And I think in the run-up to that, there will be international pressure. You know, people will be pushing, media freedom organizations will be lobbying to, you know, for the government to reverse its decision, or sorry, for the judiciary to reverse its decision. But ultimately, I think, you know, Egypt has shown that it actually doesn't give a toss with this. And you know, unless something severe and some intense pressure from, you know, a united international community front happens, you know, there's a real chance these guys could be stuck there for a long time.
I think a lot of foreign heads of state are going to be looking for the phone number of President al-Sisi to say, you know, to phone him up and say, hey, dude, like, you know.
When are you going to get control of your situation?
Yeah, you know, you need to loosen up. And I think that they will try and push for a presidential pardon because that's the way to close this matter quickly.
Right.
Because otherwise it drags on for another. I mean, the journalists were arrested 6 months ago. Mm. So it took 6 months for this trial. So we don't know how long they're going to be because they're kept in custody. So you don't know how long they're going to be in custody for. So I think that there will be intervention, you know, from various heads of state to get a pardon.
Ranjini, what's South Africa's relations like with Egypt at the moment?
Oh, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, you know, our foreign policy has dipped substantially over the last term. You know, previously we were a heavy hitter under President Mbeki in international relations. And, you know, there was our intervention in problems like this was quite visible. But I think more and more, and I think it's ever since the Libya conflict where, you know, President Zuma was accused by some African heads of states of colluding with the United States in terms of the attack on Libya, and I think since then they're treading carefully. And you see, like even with the homosexual issue in Uganda,
yes,
you know,
the fact
South
that
Africa
the president didn't
so
say
softly,
anything,
yes,
yeah.
So we are kind of you know, stepping back a lot and being a lot less vocal on international relations. I haven't seen myself, I'm not sure if there has been, but I haven't seen any statement of condemnation yet from the South African government on this. In terms of the Nigerian conflict, it's just, we stand ready to help.
Yes.
How? I mean, we sent the ANC Women's League there. What are they going to do, you know? It's like to stay in the green and say, hey, Boko Haram, you know, come chat.
Oh, dear. Mm. Okay, well, let's bring it closer to home. South Africa's main platinum mining union has said that its members have agreed to a wage settlement and that the strike will officially come to an end. This is after 5 long months of a strike that's obviously had a huge impact and has damaged our economy. I think we are all glad that the strike is over, but let's look at this damage that has now been caused. Economically, we've been downgraded, so the damage is there. Is it a case of too little, too late?
Well, I think, first of all, we've got to be glad that it's over,
you
know, and that it's not carrying on and that there's some kind of resolution has been found. You know, the platinum mines themselves are claiming some, you know, 23 billion rand in lost revenues. You know, the miners themselves have lost out 10 billion rand or so in wages. So there's going to be this whole reconciliation process now, which has to, you know, there's a back pay issue where they are working back the increase, you know, I think from the beginning of 2013 in some cases. So the guys will get a payment for the back pay as well. And just, you know, I think everyone's glad that it's just over. We can move forward from now and we can start fixing the severe damage that has happened over the last 5 months.
Well, let's talk about fixing that damage, Ranjini, because it is going to be a few tough months ahead.
Yes, there will be a few tough months ahead because, you know, obviously the mining companies need to make up for all the time that was lost in production. And, you know, in terms of the demands for platinum has increased. But I think the bigger impact is what this does for labor relations in South Africa, because I think the strike has changed the ball game. And, you know, the fact that the workers stuck it out for 5 months, they were losing their homes and their cars were being repossessed. Many of them were starving. Their families were starving. They were left destitute. But they stuck it out. And, you know, it says something that there's a new kind of desperation in the South African workforce. And I think it puts pressure on business and government to say you cannot continue to operate in the way you have been in the past 20 years, where there is this huge economic gap from the people on the ground, the workers, and, you know, government on one hand and the corporates on the other hand. And, you know, I think, you know, various political parties and COSATU have tried to raise this matter before, that you need to address the wage gap question and the levels of inequality in the country. And I think that government has been coasting along, say, yeah, we'll get to it eventually. And what the strike has done has said, deal with it now. And you know, in the we saw that the Minister of Mineral Resources, Nwako Ramatlodi, had tried to intervene in the negotiations, and he was not able to. So that also shows that government is it doesn't have the kind of influence and power that it thinks it does have. That the ultimate negotiating power rests with the workers if they buckle down and if they stay firm to what their demands are. And I think this did set a precedent, and I think everybody's going to be more cautious about it. Obviously, it's going to cause fright amongst the investor community, because they're going to say, oh gosh, should you take the risk of investing in South Africa where you have workers who are on the verge of rebellion, or should we take our business elsewhere? So, you know, the onus also on the business sector and on government to calm those fears and say, we are setting in place a process to prevent this happening again, because it can happen again.
Mm.
This settlement is in the platinum sector for 3 years, so there should be some level of stability there. But there's no guarantee that in any other sector in the economy that this could happen, you know, where the workers just go out and say, deal with other issues along with the wage issue, deal with our living conditions, deal with other issues such as, you know, medical aid and pensions and allowances and things. And that was what made the strike so complicated, is because you couldn't just negotiate and say this percent or that percent, because it dealt with a whole range of things, including, and I think this is a huge issue for mining communities, is their living conditions, because it gives rise to all sorts of other social issues. You know, the health of the mine workers, the security, their security, the levels of education, their ability to advance, whether they're stuck in that rut for the rest of their lives, or their children at least have the ability to rise out of it.
If you look at the relationship between the unions and the workers and then the private companies, there were also allegations being made that the unions didn't necessarily have the workers' best interests at heart. Do you think that was a fair comment to make? You know, for 5 months, these workers were the ones who were not bringing salaries home. They're the ones that organizations like the Gift of the Givers had to go in and assist. You didn't see the unions doing that. Do you think that's a fair comment to make against the unions? Do they always have the workers' best interests at heart, or does it become political for them?
In this case, you know, AMCU will say that they had the best interests of the workers at heart. Hasn't always been the case when unions have been out there pushing for strike action, and politics has got involved a lot of the times. You know, AMCU will say that, you know, that it was worth it. They will say that the 5 months that they were on strike and getting no pay, you know, will ensure a better future for these guys, and that something drastic had to happen. And I think, you know, as Ranjeni touched on earlier on, that, you know, that this isn't something that we could delay, or that they could delay, into the future indefinitely. So from their point of view, and I think from changing the conditions and sort of changing the face of that, that the labor market in that specific sector, you know, something drastic had to be done, and this is what they did. And, you know, they will say that they, you know, the workers will now be better off going forward because of what happened.
The mining companies have also said that given the length of the strike, you know, they're going to have to restructure, and some of these workers might even lose their jobs because they might be forced to cut jobs because of all the repair work that they have to do.
That was the initial danger, but I think part of the settlement deal now is that there won't be any immediate retrenchments. But, you know, there's no dictating what happens in the next year or two and whether that is a realistic thing to happen, because if the industry, you know, suffers more setback and it's unsustainable for the mining companies to continue to operate at the rate that they do, or if there, for example, if there's a sale in the companies that come up, you know, then that guarantee, I don't know if it will be able to stick. But I think as far as, you know, your previous question with regard to AMCU, I think, you know, there's a huge difference between the workers on the ground and the union bosses, because they live quite comfortable lives. You know, they don't realize, I mean, they, of course it is their workers, so, you know, they know the hardships, but they don't physically suffer the hardships that the workers do. They don't have the same pain, level of pain. So I think AMCU did push, and push very hard, because they wanted to make a political point using the strike. And, you know, there's a big background to it. It stems from 2012 and what happened at Marikana. And there was a lot of anger in that community, and I think that's why they stuck it out. That's why they were able to last this long. And I think it was that, you know, things went horribly wrong in 2012 with the same demand, the 12.5 demand, and people lost their lives for it. And I think that is why they pushed this hard, to say we'll stick it out for as long. And that gave AMCU the ability to do what no other union in South Africa has been able to do, is basically hold the economy hostage.
Now, speaking of putting South Africa's labor laws under a microscope, where are the positives? Where are the negatives? Because I think what the strike has highlighted mostly is where we're failing, where we're getting it wrong, where the negatives are. But where would you say the positives are when it comes to our labor laws?
Well, I think it's in terms of preserving the rights, you know, that there is a lot of protection for workers under the current legislation, to the extent where the business sector and investors believe that there's too much protection for workers, you know, that they can't lay off workers just willy-nilly, and that the strikes are protected, you know. So I think, you know, that does give some level of protection, you know, for workers. But, you know, on the other hand, you see that government has been agitating to get more powers to be able to resolve strikes, you know, once it gets to a certain point. Now, the problem with that is who decides what the point is and when, you know, the point is reached, because it means that it gives government excessive powers. So a strike can be going on for a week and government can say, okay, that's enough, it's too damaging to the economy, this is the settlement and you have to accept it. So I think the constitution at the moment and the current set of labor laws doesn't allow that to happen. So I think, you know, government needs to clarify exactly what it is looking for and what it wants to be able to do.
Now, speaking of trying to avoid a situation like this from happening again, do you think that this kind of example will be used to strengthen relationships between unions and companies? Will it improve on relationships? Will it not make a difference at all? Will we be dealing with something like this 3 years from now?
Geez, it'd be nice to say that, you know, that the incentive or the need to strike will be over. Mm. But, I mean, the chance of that is very slim. I think companies will use this and look into it quite deeply and say, you know, how can we avoid this going forward? But if we look back at our history, you know, strikes almost part and parcel of, you know, of especially the mining sector as well, where we have such low-paid, unskilled laborers, you know, taking their lives into their own hands every time they go down a mine shaft. And I think as long as those conditions exist, we're always going to see this kind of, you know, the strike action and the need for more and higher wages, you know, for people who are taking on those risks. So whether they'll be able to learn from this, I mean, let's hope they do. Let's hope they do. Let's hope that they take the lessons from, you know, what we've seen over the last couple of days and weeks in terms of, you know, the progress that was made to get to that resolution, and, you know, and how they dealt with the, you know, with the unions going forward. You know, it's hard to say that, you know, those lessons will be learned, but we can only hope.
Okay. I think that the strike was a big wake-up call for everyone concerned, but particularly for government, because now there is more intervention. The president announced last week in the State of the Nation address that there is a team that's going to be interministerial team headed up by the minister in the presidency, Jeff Khadebe, to deal precisely with the condition in mining communities. So some of these grievances that were in the strike demand, such as the living conditions, are going to be addressed by the highest level in the state. And this, I think, this is the first time you get this kind of intervention, where you have a whole team of ministers saying, okay, let's deal with this now. Let's get down and see what the grievances are. So I think there is a concerted effort. Hopefully, you know, they'll see it through and be able to set in place measures that will, because there is a mining charter at the moment that is supposed to deal precisely with this, but it places the onus on the mining companies. So one of the grievances raised by the economic freedom fighters is that government is not being tough enough in implementing that mining charter, and that is why you have this kind of situation arising. So hopefully now that there's a two-pronged approach. One is a greater adherence to the mining charter, and this interministerial community that will be addressing a whole range of issues, including education, the social issues, water, proper housing in mining communities. So, you know, it's a multi-pronged approach that should prevent, at least in this sector, in the mining sector, that, you know, anytime soon from this kind of thing happening.
And I think another good reason why this has finally come to an end is because you don't want it to cause a domino effect where it's spilling into other sectors like the gold mining sector. And, you know, you just see things get out of control.
Yeah, exactly. I think that you know that it's lucky that the pending strike action in the gold sector has not been resolved. Mm. So that's not going to happen. But there is a huge strike coming in the metal sector, led by NUMSA. And NUMSA is another kettle of fish altogether. They're also extremely militant. They also can't be reined in by government very easily. And they have at least 200,000 workers that will be affected by that strike. So, and that will also make a big impact on the economy because it affects different sectors like manufacturing, you know, which is a great generator of economic activity in South Africa. So there's a huge danger of the impact of that strike, which is supposed to start on the 1st of July.
Cliffcentral.com. This is the News Talk Hour with me, Mabali Moloi, and this afternoon I'm joined by Stilly and Ranjini from the Daily Maverick, going through some of the top news stories from the last couple of days. Now, a story that has also had a lot of people talking, of course, involves the acting COO of the SABC, Hlaudi Motsweneng. Okay, so first we heard in reports just a little over a week ago that the chiefs from the Venda tribe, they gifted Hlaudi Motsweneng with a cow, a calf, and a beautiful 23-year-old young woman as his wife. And then a week later, you're hearing reports of how journalists have convened at a press conference, and they're basically being told to retract the story because it was false. How do you get a story like this wrong? Who gets it wrong? Is it the journalists? Is it the chiefs retracting from their actions and trying to make it seem like the journalists had it wrong from the word go? What is happening here?
I think the big question in this thing is that once the report came out a week and a half ago, if it was wrong, why didn't Hlaudi Motsweneng and the Venda cultural group say immediately, hey, no, you misinterpreted it. The woman was just standing there and she just brought the cow over and, you know, you didn't quite understand what's going on. It was, you know, lost in translation.
Yeah.
They didn't do that until it became a huge palaver and the gender commission instituted an investigation and, you know, there's an outcry in society about it. And then you say, and the messages are also different because the woman involved and the cultural group is saying, no, she's engaged to someone else. She wasn't offered. But Hlaudi Motsweneng said he was offered, the choice of four women, but it was just a gesture.
Yes.
So as far as he understood it, he received the gift.
So are you trying to say that people are just trying to cover their tracks here? They're trying to make it seem like the journalists completely made up the story and had it wrong.
I think there's something really fishy going on here because, okay, there were three gifts.
There was the cow.
The cow and the calf.
And the calf.
Where are they?
We want evidence.
Yeah, where are they? Because those were taken, you know? So, and they didn't say, oh no, the cow is just passing by also. And, you know, Hlaudi thought it was for him to take home.
But now the woman in question, this 23-year-old woman, she was also present at this press conference and she was quoted saying, you know, you people have ruined my life because I was engaged to this man. And now this whole story has caused a problem. I am very proud of my culture, but this is not what happened. You are lying.
Yeah. And there's also reports that he chose the cow over the girl as well.
Oh boy.
I guess in a case like this it is easy to kind of point to, you know, the media misquoting, misrepresenting statements. As Ranjini says, you know, if you look at the timing of the denials coming out and you look at the editor of the Sowetan sticking by the original story, you know, it does seem like something is quite fishy here and you know, what a huge, you know, disrespectful action against women's rights in this country.
Well, let's touch on women's rights and let's talk about the people that we did hear speak up on with regards to the story. The Commission for Gender Equality, the Department of Women said that it supported the investigation into this gift. But who we didn't hear from was the ANC's Women's League.
Yes.
Which people are now saying, well, there you go again. Another example of how the Women's League is this toothless organization that's really just patronizing because they don't do anything.
Well, you know, the thing, and one of the things is that this power of Hlaudi Motsweneng, because people are really scared of him. And also, even before we get to the NC Women's League, why did they need to give him this gift? What's this fantastic thing he's done in running the SABC that lands him the cow, the calf, and the wife? You know, I don't. That's what I don't understand. What did the Venda Cultural Group think Shlaudi had achieved in the first place? But
even if they hadn't gifted him the wife, why would they still gift him with the cow and the car?
Exactly. And what's so extraordinary about what he does? But this isn't the first time where you see these bizarre things happening with Shlaudi Motsoeneng. You had previously this big religious service at the SABC where there was like 12 bishops who came to lay hands and pray for Shlaudi, you know, as if he's this protected species and there's this delicate, fragile thing that needs to be prayed for from the forces of evil. So
maybe these chiefs and these bishops and leaders know something special about this man that the rest of us are
just not
seeing
yet.
Exactly,
this is the bizarre thing. But I think this is also the problem with the ANC Women's League, is because, you know, it's one thing to, to be visible in the Oscar Pistorius trials and to be sitting there and make good photo opportunities in your green outfit. It's a whole other thing, I think, to take on Shlaudi Motsoeneng, who's, you know, this, it's imperceptible what his real power is. So I think this is, it's one thing if they said, we're trying to get our facts right, we're trying to determine what exactly happened here. But they didn't even say that. They've just been quiet about it. And that raises question is, what exactly is your role?
Yes.
You know, in terms of, you're supposed to be there advancing the cause of women in the ruling party and in society.
Mm.
If on an issue like this, where you don't even think it's necessary for you to speak, then the reason for your existence really needs to be questioned.
Especially because some people have said, you know, the Women's League was an organization that once stood for women's rights and fought for women's rights, but over time, that seems to have dwindled. And really, they're just an organization of women being told what to do by the men in the ANC? I don't know.
Well, Rebecca Davis wrote an article on a book that is out that was written by Wits Politics Professor Shireen Hasim, and saying, you know, the ANC Women's League has been involved in a couple of controversies surrounding, you know, their role in progressing women's rights. And even from its very beginning days, its early days, there have been a lot of instances where, you know, they've been seen as either a token movement or haven't had the support of within the ANC to be able to be something more than just that. And, you know, even within the ANC, the right for women to vote within the organization only came in 31 years after the formation of the ANC itself. There were other examples supporting Jacob Zuma when the big battle with Thabo Mbeki came up, where Thabo Mbeki was a staunch supporter, but he was a bigger supporter of women's rights within the ANC than let's say Jacob Zuma was. But when the time came for backing one or the other in the big battle of Polokwane, the ANC Women's League went with Jacob Zuma. Mm. So there've been numerous instances throughout the history of the Women's League where they have failed to sort of stand up for what is supposed to be their mandate in progressing and looking after the rights of women within
the organization. You see that the ANC Women's League actually undermines the cause of women sometimes. Like when the questions are raised about whether South Africa is ready yet for a woman president, and they say, well, no, not really.
Mm.
You know, that shows that they have no confidence in what they're doing. They don't have the courage of their convictions, that they themselves see their role as being a rubber stamping body to endorse the positions of the mother body. And they don't want to do anything or say anything that will make those in power uncomfortable. So, for example, during President Zuma's rape trial, you saw again that, you know, the ANC Women's League gagged itself.
Yeah.
And wouldn't speak at that time.
They wouldn't say anything bad about the trial.
So, you know,
the president.
They want to be able to speak when it's convenient to do so and be visible when it's convenient to do so. So, for example, the Pistorius trial, it's fine to make a statement and show, you know, some support for Rivers Tien Kam's mother. But what exactly is the impact of your actions? What does it do? Because you don't sustain it in other gender violence cases.
I think they also spoke up against the Boko Haram incident with the kidnapped girls.
But what is the impact of their actions?
Yeah.
And the rule seems to be, as long as it doesn't make the leadership of the ANC uncomfortable, then they're fine. They, you know, they'll do their woman's thing there. But the minute it causes a little bit of insecurity
discomfort
or discomfort for the leaders of within the ANC, they're nowhere to be seen.
Right. Well, all I can say is I bet you there's some people who will be keeping an eye on Shaudi to see if he gets married anytime soon.
And I'm sure there are some hungry people at the SABC waiting for their piece of steak.
From the cow.
The cow is supposed to be the property of the SABC.
Yes, it was gifted to the entire SABC.
And the reason for the gift was that he was moving the headquarters of Palapala radio station to Polokwane. And this is why the vendor people came out to give him...
That's very generous of them.
Yeah. It's a pity that you guys left the SABC. You probably could have cashed in as well.
This was the problem. Our timing was all wrong. Ranjeni Sili, thank you so much for coming in and joining me this afternoon for the News Talk Hour here on Cliff Central with the Daily Maverick. Remember to log on to dailymaverick.co.za, subscribe to the newsletter, and every morning the team from the Daily Maverick will make sure that they update you with the very latest that's happening in the world around us. CliffCentral.com.